folks are taking their seats, so I'm going to go ahead and kick things off. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this special open house event. I'm Mo Pepin with Environmental Defense Fund, and we have a special program for y'all today, which has been brought to us by EDF's Osprey Legacy Society, who I have the pleasure of working with. So we'd like to extend a special thank you to our society members that are here today, those of you who have remembered EDF in your estate plans. If you'd like to learn more about plan giving opportunities for supporting our work, my colleague Nick in the plaid shirt or myself would be thrilled to meet you. Thank you very much to the Health Museum for hosting us. EDF is really thrilled to be partnering with y'all through a two-year grant made possible with funding from the Gulf Research Program of the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. This grant allows for the creation of an interactive environmental health exhibit here at the Health Museum, as well as the development of a field trip experience for student visitors to the museum, educating students about air pollution and the connections between environmental exposures and human disease. And finally, thank you very much to the many individuals who have had a hand in producing this event. Your efforts are greatly appreciated. Presenting today will be Dr. Elena Kraft, a senior director at Environmental Defense Fund for over a decade. She has strategized to identify, monitor, and mitigate risk from environmental pollution from the industrial sector as well as from within the transportation sector, most specifically around port areas and freight corridors. In addition, she has facilitated development of initiatives to support public health research, including helping to establish the Hurricane Harvey Health and Housing Registry in Houston, the first registry established after a major flood event. Dr. Kraft's other scientific research focuses on understanding health disparities associated with living in pollution hotspots. She holds a Bachelor's of Science degree in biology from UNC Chapel Hill, a Master's of Science degree in toxicology from North Carolina State University, and a PhD from Duke University. She also holds an adjunct assistant professorship at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center, Texas A&M University, and is a Kinder Fellow at Rice University. Our co-founder, our co-presenter, Sarah Vogel, is unfortunately able to join us today due to an unexpected family obligation. Following Elena's presentation, we'll open the floor for a Q&A, which we'll have plenty of time for questions. And when we get to that portion, we ask that you please just share your name with us as you're asking your question as this event is being recorded. And before we turn it over to Elena, I'm pleased to introduce LaTanya Miles, Director of Education and Public Programming with the Health Museum, who will be sharing a few words with us.
Hello, my name is Becky Seabrook, and I'm the Senior Director of Guest Experiences here at the Health Museum. I've actually only been here for a couple of weeks, and I've been extremely excited to find out about this partnership from LaTanya. So I want to welcome you all to the Health Museum. We have been in this building since 1996, though we're actually celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. And it's a really exciting time to be here, not only to look at where we've been, but where we're going in the community and beyond. And it's partnerships like this that make it so exciting, with the ability to go ahead and address the really important issues that are happening in the community. So thank you so much for being a part of what we're doing here. And now I'm going to pass it over to LaTanya.
We're really excited about the partnership. And our goals are to build a healthier community. And so building healthier communities through partnerships like this one really help us to fulfill our mission. Over the course of our history, we've served over 3 million visitors here at the Health Museum. So we have the reach to really have impact and, again, creating an opportunity for people to develop healthier lives. Our mission in general is to foster wonder and curiosity around health, medical science, and the human body. And what better way to do that than, with partnerships like this one? Our values are individualized, inspirational, and evidence-based. Again, that allows us to take content like we are doing here with the Environmental Defense Fund and this programming to really give students and the general public an opportunity to take the information and content through the field trip experience, exhibit piece, and really internalize that and apply it to their everyday life. And again, through partnerships, this is our ecosystem. Again, through partnerships like this one and others that we have, it allows us to really reach our mission, our goal and the purpose and mission of the museum. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Since opening in 1996, we've served over 3 million patrons here at the museum. And in terms of school groups, we've served over 87,000. And so again, with the programming, it allows us to have a really expansive reach to reach students at an early age to build a foundation and learn about environmental science and health issues, which is a great, great synergy in what we do in our mission and the goal of our grant. I'm going to let Becky talk just a little bit about the exhibit that we have in our global kitchen that's opening. And again, environmental issues, sustainability, food from around the world.
Yes, one of the things I'm very excited about doing here at the museum, looking at the exhibits, both the exhibits that we bring in from other wonderful institutions like this one from the American Museum of Natural History, but also some of the exhibits that we'll be developing in-house, such as the one that we're going to be doing with this partnership. This is an example of one that's coming in at the beginning of June, and it looks at the issue of food from a global perspective, how it's grown, the marketplace, how we're interconnected, the role that food plays in our culture and our celebrations in society. So we're actually really excited not only about the exhibition, but about some of the programming that will tie into the exhibit when it comes. So if it's something that you're interested, I hope that we'll see you back. But this is just one example of some of what we'll be doing. And like I said, I'm very excited about the coming years when we'll be doing a lot more with expanding the exhibits that are both here and out in the community.
And this is just an overview of programming, ways and places within the museum that we are able to integrate topics like environmental science, air quality, our discovery camps, and a big portion of what we're doing is for our Faces of Innovation Global Team Summit, where our students who participate in this week-long experience we'll have an opportunity to explore real-world problems in environmental science and looking at how do we look at air quality and how do they create and develop innovative solutions to these issues. We have scouts, outreach, academic adventures, which really looks at career readiness skills. Another place where we look at how do we integrate important topics like this one, internships, homeschool, mindfulness, and social motion. These are all just programs that we have here at the museum. And outreach. Our outreach programming gives us an opportunity to take topics like we're developing for our field trip experience in partnership here with EDF, where we can look at how do we take that in outreach into classrooms in the schools, into the community. And again, a part of that field trip experience that was mentioned earlier, we look at how do we look at the body and health, and how do we incorporate those same topics in what we're doing in our field trip experience. We have Girl Scout programming where we have opportunities to explore many topics as well. And again, these are just a few images for you to take a look at of our Faces of Innovation Summit, Global Teen Summit from past years. And we are very excited to have the participation of schools who are involved in the program this year. Other activities we have at the museum are our Cocktails and Conversation, which are public programming where we really look at important conversations where we explore various topics in health, science, and medicine. We offer educator workshops. And another big thing for us, we're a Smithsonian affiliate, the only one here in the city of Houston. And so we have access to the Smithsonian resources, and it's a great opportunity for us to leverage that in various partnerships as well. Thank you.
everybody. I really want to thank you all for being here. It is nice to see so many friendly faces. I've known many of you for several years, and you all supported our work in Houston, and I just couldn't be more thankful and grateful for your time and efforts to support our Houston work. It's especially wonderful to be here to share some of the ways in which our Houston work has grown and become more sophisticated. And I guess one of the biggest ways that we've grown is that we're actually now up to 6 full-time staff in Houston, which is just remarkable. I remember over a decade ago when I started at EDF, I was a one-woman show out of a kind of a rented office space off of Allen Parkway, and now we've got folks all over the city. So I wanted to just have, you know, folks raise their hand. Matt Trousseau is here. He is manager of our One Breath Partnership Program. Matt was the environmental reporter for the Houston Chronicle for over a decade, you know, it was just so wonderful to have him come on board. He knew all of the issues, obviously, very well. He knew all the partners, just a wealth of information. We've just been so excited to have him on board. Grace T. Lewis is here. She's an epidemiologist. She's actually officing out of the University of Texas Health Sciences Center, and is mentored by Dr. Elaine Szymanski, who is also here, a longtime partner and collaborator on some of our research projects, including trying to understand more about the specific health implications of air pollution. And Shannon is in the back here. You all may have met her recently. Shannon is one of our newer staff here in Houston and is managing the National Academy of Sciences program, which is you've heard a little bit about with the partnership with the museum here. Really, what we were initially trying to do with that program was to get environmental science included into curriculums at different high schools, especially high schools along the Ship Channel, because we think it's so important for the younger generation to understand how climate, how pollution impacts their daily lives. And so we're lucky enough to have Shannon, who was wrangling high school students to come to youth council meetings, to host town halls for elected officials. She is a brave soul that will be taking 12 high school students to D.C. to meet with their elected officials. And she was also instrumental in running our video contest. We have a video contest. This is the 3rd year in a row where we have asked students to develop a 3-minute video highlighting what air pollution means to them. This was the first year where we had a People's Choice option for the video contest. We had 8,000 views of that of the People's Choice Award. So the message is getting out, and it's super exciting. Our newest hire is Alan West. See Alan here? He's also from the Chronicle, and I have told Matt and Alan that, you know, do not burn bridges with the Houston Chronicle because we're stealing all their best talent. And so they've assured me that we're still in the good graces of the paper. And so, but I think what it means to me is that we have all of that expertise and all of those skills that have been brought over to EDF, and it just is so meaningful. I also want to introduce Maya Draper. She is our program manager. She's actually based in Austin, and we keep trying to find a Houston Maya, and we just can't do it. She is just a wonderful asset to our organization and so thorough in the work and pays so much attention to detail. And as you can understand, with all of this work, it really matters. You know, what is the specific concentration? How do you get students over to participate in a program? How do you make these projects successful? And Maya's a master of putting all of that together. So just wanted to highlight some of our our best talent at the organization. I wanted to also explain a little bit about a couple of projects that we have in Houston. This is, I would say, a light summary of the many projects. We're laughing because there's so many projects that no one can understand all the extent to which EDF has our hands all over everything. But one of the projects that we have that was funded recently, actually by Houston Endowment, was a project called the One Breath Partnership. And the idea behind the One Breath Partnership is that it's a collective impact project, meaning that we're trying to leverage all of the skills, all of the expertise across a range of organizations. So EDF is the lead organization. We work with Environmental Integrity Project, Environment Texas, Air Alliance Houston, Rice University, and Public Citizen. And EDF has been instrumental in amplifying the message and the work of all of those organizations individually. Just to give you a sense of the impact that One Breath Partnership has had, in the 25 months that Matt has been here, we have had over 5,000 news stories about air quality in Houston. That is an average of 6.5 per day. So you can just imagine the incredible outreach and the impact that the impact that those stories have had on the news collectively. And I will say that Matt came on, I think, in March or April. August was when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston. We were ready. We knew what to expect. And Matt was a master in terms of turning the message to focus on public health and the risks that existed because we're not prepared as a community for the size and magnitude and frequency of the storms that we continue to see. And the same is true for events like the ITC fire. Same is true for the barge crash this past weekend. We've had event after event, incident after incident, and Matt has made sure that we're ready, whether it be an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle, that the day after our most recent op-ed, TCEQ filed suit against ITC and the Kemco facility. That's never happened. So, you know, we are making meaningful progress here, and it's exciting to be part of it. And I also wanted to highlight the work that we're doing with the city of Houston. Many of you saw the MAML, the mobile air monitoring bus that is outside. We have been working with the city hand in hand to try to get out and take measurements in neighborhoods. One of the things that has been the hardest in terms of messaging is that we constantly hear from, say, TCEQ, well, yes, we saw some elevated concentrations, but nothing to worry about here. And, you know, they'll say that based on three measurements that they have taken in a city that's 624 square miles big. So, you know, we have really gone in with the city and said, wait a minute, what about the pollution in Manchester? What about the pollution in Deer Park? Where are your measurements? What are your measurements? And how can we amplify the impact and the understanding of the actual concentrations and what they mean in terms of public health? Because honestly, when people in the communities are smelling gasoline, when they see a plume come over their neighborhood, they know that everything is not fine. And so we are really pushing back against that kind of rhetoric that we hear frequently. And the way that we've been able to do that is to use sound science, the most sophisticated technology you can get. And that's why we actually wanted the city to bring the bus out today, because the city of Houston, throughout the entire region, has the most sophisticated air monitoring equipment of anybody in the region. And that's exciting. And there are actually some of the monitoring that EDF did following Hurricane Harvey, where we detected the very high concentrations of benzene in Manchester. The city saw the value of that specific technology, and they applied for some funds from the Center for Disease Control. And they actually were awarded funds and purchased two new units that will be installed on that bus. That's incredible. It puts us in a position where we are actually able to go out at the neighborhood level and understand more at that hyper-local level about the air pollution in that area, to the degree that we can get an actual measurement of benzene or toluene or xylene, and we can tell exactly where it's coming from. And that's where we start to see that transformational change, because facilities can't hide behind one another. Oh, well, it was my neighbor. It must have had that release. It wasn't us. Or in the Valero case with Manchester, we reported 6.7 pounds. Really? We measured 350 part per billion. I don't think your release was only 6.7 pounds. So with science, we are able to go out and really get something done and change the conversation. And that part has been just so exciting and so valuable. We've also worked with the city. I think maybe some of you have read about the instruments that we had installed on the Google cars. We had those driving around Houston for a while, collecting information on PM, ozone, trying to understand more about the pollution at the neighborhood level. It's not our goal to drive around every single city in the Google car. It would be great, but what we really want to do is to put that technology in the hands of those at the city so that they can install monitors on the cars that they're already driving around. And then their fleet is now a new platform to be collecting information that they can use to better protect public health. So it all kind of fits together as we work to build, one unit that can work together to address these air quality issues. And then the health registry. This is work that we put together with the health, with the City of Houston Health Department, as well as Rice University. It is the first registry of its kind in the nation. We had a release, a report. We released the report of the first year's findings back in February. That was done in partnership with the mayor of Houston. And we identified those communities where they didn't receive services for an average of 20 weeks, whereas some other areas across the city were getting services in 2 weeks. Why is there that disparity? How many homes were damaged? How long did it take folks to get back in to their homes? What kinds of health impacts did they experience because their home had been flooded? And that's just super exciting work. And then I also wanted to share just a little bit. Part of the reason why we're here tonight is to outline the incredible opportunity that we have in Texas right now. We see Texas as this amazing place where there are things happening here that are not happening everywhere else. And, as you know, EDF has historically focused on doing a lot of work in California and New York. And Texas has not been high on the list for visits from Fred Krupp, our president. But we see that changing, actually. And we see more of a focus on Texas and on Houston. Because the fact is if you want to address climate pollution, if you want to address air pollution, the only way to do that in a meaningful way is to bring Texas along and to show that it can be done here. And so that's super exciting. And so some of the ways in which we're leveraging some of that energy in Houston, as I mentioned, our six full-time staff that we have, we're actually opening an office in the next couple of months near Sawyer Heights, so that will be super exciting. We have hired a Moms Clean Air Force consultant. So Moms Clean Air Force is a sister organization to EDF. their mission, they're 2 million strong now, and their mission is to bring moms out to hearings to demand that we get the public health protections that we need and that are afforded to us through the Clean Air Act. And they are a powerful force. I can tell you that, you know, if you show up to testify in front of Congress and you have a row of moms sitting behind you, watch out. And, you know, we're working as closely as we ever have with some of our elected officials. So, as you all know, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, 28-year-old Latino woman. We're having conversations about what should the job description be of the director of the Bureau of Pollution, of Air Pollution. What should that job be? We have the opportunity to inform things like that. And then one of the most exciting pieces of news, just recently, our newest national board member is actually Marilyn Miranda, who is the provost of Rice University. And so bringing Houston to light on a national scale through participation on our national board is going to be just great to bring more attention to Houston. And then one final thing is that Matt has been working extremely hard to get the Society of Environmental Journalists to host their conference in 2 years in Houston. That is remarkable. It will be the opportunity to have 800 to 1,000 of environmental journalists from around the country come to Houston to learn about all of the projects, all of the work that's going on here. And that's just a remarkable opportunity. So with that, I wanted to leave some time for questions, but I do want to encourage you all to take a look at the bus that's outside. Go inside it, you know, just get your hands on it. Just look and see, you know, these are the kinds this is the equipment that we are using to try to address some of our most serious air quality issues. And then, yeah, so I think we have a couple of microphones that are being sent around. Okay. Any questions?
Does the EPA listen to you?
Depends who at the EPA. So I will share that there are lots of good folks at the EPA who are career staff, who are career scientists, and they do not like the direction that the current administration is taking the EPA. The president's last two budgets have essentially tried to wipe out EPA's budget, 30-40% cuts. Some of those cuts are for things like the Chemical Disaster Safety Board. Those are the people who come out after the Arkema event, after Hurricane Harvey. Those are the people who are coming out after the ITC fires. I don't see how we can cut the Chemical Disaster Safety Board. So there are people that we are working with on the inside. We are trying. I would say we are aggressively working to call attention to the work that Andy Wareham has done in his career, sort of carrying water for a lot of the polluters that are really violating the laws and are not supporting efforts to control climate pollutants. And those are deep relationships that he has. But this is the same. You know, we had the same work that we did with Scott Pruitt when he was administrator. So, what you know, we'll work with anyone who will work with us. I think what we're trying to do is we want to call attention to the bad actors, and we want to highlight those who are doing good things. We've had a lot of companies who have stood up and said, we need methane regulations, or we need limits on carbon. And so we are trying to stand up with those companies, with those facilities that are trying to make those commitments. And so the answer is yes, with some folks, we are doing that. We're trying our very best. Well, the Railroad Commission does not actually regulate air quality. That's TCEQ. We do have some partnerships with the Railroad Commission. One of the most challenging pieces, I think, of our work with them is that the laws are not very protective of things like wastewater and produced water that get generated from fracking. And one of the things that we've seen lately, and what our groundwater team has been working on, is trying to protect against some of the efforts to recycle the produced water. So the idea is that there's all this excess water that results from drilling and fracking. And in some cases, what they're trying to do is to spray that material back onto agricultural fields or, reuse that water. That's problematic because of all of the materials that we know is in produced water. It's also problematic because of the materials that we don't know are in produced water. And so we're actually working with our natural gas team to find better solutions. In Texas, it's not as, because we have injection wells here, we haven't seen the magnitude of that kind of issue as in other places like Pennsylvania, for example, but it's a serious issue.
I think there's a bill that passed the House and I think is in the Senate in Texas right now, like the saying that you can dump, that the CCEQ can give people permission to just dump the fracking water wherever the heck they feel like. I'm being exaggerated.
Yeah. I don't actually know that specific bill. But
I think it's because they're having problems getting rid of the water. Like they're just producing so much at this point that they're getting into it. They don't have anywhere
to put it. And one of the things that's been challenging, especially in a place like Pennsylvania, for example, where they don't have the injection wells, they actually have to truck that water somewhere. Well, if you're trucking this material, then you're opening it up for the opportunity for a spill on the highway or an accident. And so there are all kinds of concerns that we have. I think, where EDF sees, I think long-term, EDF is certainly of the mind that we need to phase out fossil fuels. To the extent that natural gas is a stepping stone to that, we say if you are going to frack, if you are going to drill, then do it in the most responsible way possible. But I think the reality is if we want to solve the climate crisis, if we want to solve some of these air pollution issues, then there has to be a path to zero emissions. That's the only way forward. I don't know that you will read that in our annual report, but I think as part of our internal strategy, that's what we're thinking. We distinguish ourselves from NRDC a bit in that way. They've called for bans on fracking in different places. Well, our position is, the train has left the station. The fracking is happening in states across the country. So it's not necessarily as effective to have a position like that when we feel like we might be able to get further working with these companies individually. And we have, I think you're probably all aware of the methane satellite that we're launching in 2021. The intent there is to, again, shine light on the climate pollution that is created by extraction of that natural gas and to do it on the global scale, which will be unprecedented. And something that, frankly, a nonprofit was never, no one would ever imagine that an EDF would be able to do that. But we have leveraged the scientists, the satellite experts, We have partnerships with lots of physicists. I mean, it's just really amazing. And if you look at the history of our work on methane, EDF was, you know, essentially the foundation for the methane controls that EPA put forward. I mean, that is remarkable. And the only way that we're able to do that, and the only way that we're able to do that with any of our other work is because we have the science to back us up. And we can say, look, we need this policy because here is the evidence and you can't dispute it. And that has been our path forward. Yes.
During Hurricane Harvey, to measure the pollution?
Yes.
And it was declined? Or did you measure it anyway?
Well, so we did, after Hurricane Harvey, actually the city, because we had those partnerships, they said, could you help us? And so we said, yes. Let's get some monitoring equipment out there. What was... In my mind, the most disheartening thing about all of the monitoring that happened after Hurricane Harvey, so as you all are probably aware, TCEQ shuts the air monitors down in advance of those kinds of storms. And so there's literally nothing that is able to capture pollution. And so everyone knows that. But they don't take action to then say, okay, well, our stationary monitoring network is down. Maybe we should have a plan B. Maybe we should bring out a mobile unit that we can deploy when we know or when we identify places where there might be a problem. And so the EPA has a bus that's similar to the one that you'll see outside. They have two of those. After Hurricane Harvey, one was in Nevada and one was in North Carolina. It took them 4 days to get there. And so that, to me, was the most frustrating piece. So after Hurricane Harvey, we did work with the city, and we deployed that monitor, and the city saw the value of that, and they actually purchased two of those units. Now, after the ITC fires, the issue around Harvey was really focused more on some of the benzene and some of the other VOCs of all-to-organic compounds. When the ITC fire broke out, you saw that plume. That was primarily PM that was of initial concern. And so, again, we talked with the city, and they said, do you have some PM monitors that we could deploy? And literally overnight, and I have Grace here to prove it, she and Elaine were up on fire stations across the city deploying a stationary network system that was the most robust network system that anybody put up after the ITC fires. Now, what happened after that was that the ITC fire went out. Well, you have 15 tanks that had various product in them that, you know, when the fire was going, that product was combusting. When the fire was out, that's when you saw the spike in benzene. So that's when we started, that's when we deployed the instrument to measure benzene. The problem was that the ITC facility was in Harris County, not with the city of Houston. And so we worked with the city. The city had a partnership with Harris County, but at some point, Harris County was not comfortable with getting assistance from the city to measure pollution. And I think that is one of the reasons why the director of the Bureau of Pollution Control left Harris County, because of the heavy criticism that he received from seemingly to be very flat-footed following this major incident. So, and that's why there's that open position. If anyone knows of a great director of the Bureau of Air Pollution, let us know. But, yeah, so with the city, yes, and we're working more with Harris County, but initially, yes, they were harder to work with. I think one of the things that was challenging about working with the county was that, you know, this was Hidalgo's very first major event. And I think she was, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so there was a lot of people running around not knowing what to do. And part of the problem was trying to understand more about the jurisdiction. So there was an incident command that was set up. So the city was working together with the county through that mechanism. But after the fire was out, that incident command was actually dissolved. And that ended up being problematic because after the fire was out was when we really saw the potential for the health risk for the communities. But at that time, the incident command had been dissolved, and so there wasn't that network of communication that should have been there. So those are things that I think they're trying to work out. But obviously, I mean, we can't have this happening over and over again. This is, yeah.
So the recordings that you made, mm-hmm. they automatically get sent in someplace, or is there somebody on the bus who's taking these monitoring, these readings?
So what happened was once we started posting our readings to the Reddy Harris County site, that's when we got the call of, oh, you're in Harris County, not in the city. And so that was when we sort of realized, oh, the city and the county are not working as collaboratively as they could. And because the instrument that we had contracted was on a city vehicle, we weren't in a position to say, sorry, you know, we're going to stay anyway. The city really wanted to respect the jurisdiction of the county. I was able, though, to, in all of this time, I mean, we're on the phone talking to reporters, we're on the phone talking to the city. I had parents calling me crying because they had 3 kids at home, and they didn't know what to do. And, you know, we went over to one of the parents' houses and we took a sample because we thought it would help her feel better to know exactly what was in the air outside of her home. And it didn't make sense scientifically. We didn't expect to see anything because by that time the wind direction had changed. But I have 2 small kids, and if I lived in that neighborhood and I had the opportunity to have someone come by, I would jump on it. And so we did, and the city was they let us do that even though it was outside of the city limits. So those are the kinds of things where I think we, you know, we try to go to the extra mile, and all of the partners that we have, the partners at the museum, the partners at UT School of Public Health, these are people who are incredibly devoted to this work. And it's just so energizing to be part of this and to see the great things that are happening. The kids that are taking part in the youth councils, one of the activities that we have them doing is getting CPR training. The purpose of doing the CPR training is to highlight the connection between exposure to air pollution and an increased risk in having a heart attack. And so if you're a high school student having to do CPR training to make that connection, because you're having to engage in that activity, you're much more likely to remember, hey, air pollution really does have a health impact, and this is what it really is. And so to the extent that we can, and that's why we're doing the partnership with the museum, the idea is to have a set of lungs at the museum where you can actually look and see what is a particulate matter, doing in my, how is it getting into my bloodstream? And so those are the kinds of hands-on things that we're really trying to do to make sure that the message gets communicated in a way that's meaningful and that's understandable to whatever audience we're speaking with. And so that part has been super exciting. Yes. Yes. So you might remember some of our original work was with school buses and trying to reduce the amount of pollution in the cabin of those buses. Most of the school buses in Houston have been updated with the model year 2010 standard or better. Where we're focused now, and this is part of our work with the city, is building out some of the they have asthma centers located at some of the high schools. And some of those places are places where we have air monitors. And so actually that was I did want to mention after the ITC fire, the high schools that we work with along the ship channel, they called Grace and they said, hey, we don't know what to do. We've had a shelter in place. Should we send the kids home? Should we keep them here? What should, and you know, so we see ourselves as providing a very rich, just deep set of expertise and skills that we're able to provide for the community. And so we're continuing that work with the schools. We're continuing that work to support the asthma centers. And even in the research that we're doing, we're really trying to understand more about the special vulnerabilities of different communities, different neighborhoods, because those are the things that I think they make pollution personal and therefore actionable.
Hi, my name is Munir Buhaya. I'm a medical student and educator here at the Hill Museum. Thanks very much for putting this event together and all your work. It's really fascinating being an advocate at the policy level and also empowering communities. Just a very general question, what are your goals, at least for the EDF's Houston, in the next year, 2 years, 5 years?
Well, we have a lot of goals. I can outline a few. One of the things that we think has to happen is we need increased monitoring, increased enforcement. We know through our One Breath partnership that only 3% of the violations that occur at these facilities are enforced upon. 3%. That's not a number that's encouraging facilities to do the right thing. In fact, because there's this reliance on self-regulation, it basically opens up facilities just, they're not, if you look at the list, at the history of violations of ITC, of ARCMA, of Chemco, they're a mile long. These are facilities that we knew had issues, that the state knew had issues in terms of not meeting, not following the law. So enforcement is one of the areas where our goal specifically is to reduce unpermitted emissions by 50% by 2025. We also have goals around getting a benzene action plan in place for the city, for the county. If you ask TCEQ, well, when would you call a shelter in place event? No one at the agency would give you a specific number. And what that means is that when you have a city official or a county official that's out there and they get a high benzene reading, they're not sure what to do about it. Well, should we stay another hour and wait till we get another reading? Or do we issue a shelter in place? Or do we issue an evacuation? That plan does not exist right now. And so that's another goal that we have. We have goals around the risk management plans that these facilities are supposed to file with EPA. We've done an analysis looking at those risk management plans, and we've found that many of those risk management plans are outdated or they're ineffective. That was an issue at the ARCMA facility. Their risk management plan for a power outage was that their generator was going to kick on. Well, their generator was stored at a level that was below where the facility was going to, if the facility were going to flood, that generator was going to be underwater. That makes no sense. So, we need people looking at those plans and assessing them. Is this reasonable? Is this realistic? And so those are the types of things that if we can go through, and it takes time to do that, it takes effort to do that. You actually can't review a risk management plan unless you go to an EPA reading room. The closest EPA reading room is in Dallas. So, you know, we have law students from UT Law Clinic, and they go up to Dallas every now and then to go to the reading room to look at these risk management plans. And that's how we slowly build up this profile of facilities. And we can say, oh, look, this facility has got X amount of material. They've had this many violations. Oh, and look, they haven't updated their risk management plan in 15 years. To us, that's a red flag. That's a facility that we need the county to send out an investigator. What's going on there? Why haven't you updated? Why haven't you done the due diligence that's needed to manage the type of materials that they're handling? These are important. I mean, I just can't stress enough the importance that the folks who work at these facilities, their day-to-day, their attention to detail, that's critically important. If they don't spend that time making sure that they follow all of the protocols, and then disasters happen. And so how can we be, how can we influence the change and generate that transformational change in the culture where they are doing that due diligence? Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate everyone coming. And like we said, please go and see the van outside. It's spectacular. And thank you. And actually, I saw Daisy come in, so I wanted to flag her as well. Daisy is with the City of Houston, and she is one of our wonderful partners who actually made it possible for the van to be here tonight. So we really value our relationship and the work that we do together with the city. So thank you all.